Okay. A little bit different this evening for our concluding session. The most visible difference you can already see, and that is that I'm not using the full screen. The reason for that will become evident in about 10 slides. The second difference is that I'm inviting you to be more active participants than you have in the past. That is, if you have not just questions, but in this case, answers, don't be shy and don't just wait until the class is over. You're certainly welcome to join in at any time. So what we've been doing over the last several weeks is looking at some of the major approaches to the subject of Tamei HaMitzvot. We've seen that the subject of both enumerating the mitzvot, that is, deciding which 613 do's and don'ts are the big 613, as well as looking at different schools of thought regarding the rationales behind either mitzvot in general or particular mitzvot. What we're going to do this evening, I've labeled as an exercise in Tamei HaMitzvot. So in essence, I am inviting all of you to join in and to become Monei HaMitzvot, to join the ranks of those like Saadia Gaon and like Rambam and like whoever the author was of Sefer HaChinuch, to voice your opinions as to what are the rationales behind some of the mitzvot. And we're going to do it by way of a fixed text. And the text is called the Azharot of Saadia Gaon. I've mentioned them previously, but just to remind you, these are the Azharot. I'm introducing them to you by way of a pasuk that describes, it's kind of like a retro look at Matan Torah. Matan Torah itself is actually in the 20th chapter of the book of Shemot. This is kind of reiteration of Matan Torah that appears some four chapters later. In it, God recalls how he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "Ale elai hahara veheyesham, ascend the mountain and be there. Ve'etnalacha, and there on the mountain, I, God, will give you, Moshe, et luchot ha'evem, the stone tablets, v'hatorah v'hamitzvah, and the Torah and the mitzvot, asher katavti lohorotam, that I have written to instruct the Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel." So, of course, we know that God gave Moses two stone tablets. But the question is, where did God give Moshe on Mount Sinai the Torah and the mitzvot? So Rashi is bothered by this. And here's Rashi's commentary on that verse. And in his commentary, Rashi says, "Kol shesh me'ot u'shlosh esrei mitzvot, all of the 613 mitzvot de'oraita of the Torah, bichlal aseret hadibrot hem, that when God said to Moshe, come up to the mountain, and there I'll give you two stone tablets and the Torah and the mitzvot," God wasn't planning on giving Moshe separate things. The stone tablets as as one entity, the Torah as a separate entity, and the mitzvot as yet a third entity. But rather, says Rashi, following Saadia Gaon, by giving Moshe the Aseret HaDibrot, the so-called Ten Commandments, God was effectively giving Moshe the entire Torah, all 613 mitzvot, because again, as Rashi says, all 613 mitzvot are contained in the Aseret HaDibrot. Furthermore, says Rashi, Rabbeinu Saadia, Peresh, Ba'azharot Sheyasad, that in the Azharot, this liturgical poem that Saadia Gaon wrote and that is recited by some Jewish communities on Shavuot, in these Azharot, in this liturgical poem, he arranged L'chol dibor v'dibor, for each and every one of the Ten Commandments, he ordered mitzvot hatluyot bo, the mitzvot that are contained in that, the singular of dibrot is diber, in that diber, in that article. So here to start us off, just to remind us, are the Ten Commandments. Okay, Anochi Hashem Elohecha, which is an interesting one in and of itself because it doesn't really command anything. It's a statement of fact, right? We can subscribe to it or we can decline to subscribe to it, but it doesn't tell us to do anything and it doesn't prohibit us from anything. Okay. The second commandment, however, Lo Yehi Elocha Elohim Acherim Al Panai, is generically speaking, the prohibition against forms of idolatry. Lotisa Shem Hashem Elohecha Lashav is, strictly speaking, a prohibition against taking a false oath. Zachorat Yom HaShabbat LeKadsho, a positive commandment to honor and to sanctify the Shabbat. Kabedet Avicha Ve'et Imecha, honoring one's parents. Lotirtzach, don't murder. Lo tin'af, don't commit adultery or incest. Lo tignov, which according to rabbinic interpretation is not a prohibition. Not that it is certainly prohibited to rob someone, but robbery doesn't really make it into the top 10. Okay. So they believe that the lo tignov in the Aseret HaDibrot is a rather particular kind of robbery, and that's kidnapping. Okay? Lo tanebre achayt shaker, not to bear false witness. And finally, lo tachmod, not to covet your neighbor's property. Okay? So these are the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, and according to Saadia Gaon, these are not so much 10 narrow, specific do's or don'ts, as much as they are 10 categories. And all of the remaining mitzvot of the Torah, both mitzvot aseh and mitzvot lo ta'aseh, fall into one or another of these 10 categories. So I'll start with a simple question. Okay? Kriyat Shema is not in the 10 commandments. Okay? However, according to Saadia, one of the Ten Commandments is a category that includes within it the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. So the question is, into which one of the 10 categories represented by the Ten Commandments do you think that the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema belongs? Now, I could make an argument for saying that it belongs in the first one of the Dibrot, in Anochi Hashem Elohecha, because when we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Eloheinu Hashem Echad, we're essentially declaring our faith. We are subscribing to the principle that God is the one who took us out of Egypt, and therefore we have accepted him to be our God and that we are his servants. I could make the same argument in a kind of converse fashion for including Kriyat Shema in the category of Lo Yehi Elocha Elohim Acherim Al Panai, because Kriyat Shema, the emphasis in Kriyat Shema is on Hashem Eloheinu Hashem Echad, on not merely the unity of God, but the uniqueness of God. And of course, emphasizing God's unity and God's uniqueness is essentially a bulwark against idolatry. I could also make a case for including the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema in the category of Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadsho, because Lo yiyelacha Elohim acherim, or Anochi Hashem Elokecha, are really observed passively. Whereas Kriyat Shema is an activity. So I might want to include it in the category of Zachor, because the category of Zachor isn't just to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, like once a week I have to say to myself, oh yeah, Shabbos is a day of rest. No, no, no. The rabbis interpret Zachor et Yom HaShabbat l'kadosho, that it requires some activity on our part to mark the Shabbat day, and that, of course, is the activity that we call Kiddush, that we recite on Friday night. So just as the recitation of Kiddush is an activity that we perform in order to demonstrate our acceptance of Shabbat, Kriyat Shema, arguably, is an activity that we perform to manifest, to illustrate our acceptance of the principle of God's unity and God's uniqueness. Okay, here's a slew of mitzvot that aren't mentioned at all in the Aseret HaDibrot. Let's start with Kashrut. Okay, into which of the categories represented by the Aseret HaDibrot would you put the laws of Kashrut, or the laws of Yovel, the Jubilee year, okay, or Terumot u'Ma'asrot, or the prohibition against cross-dressing, or for that matter, everybody's favorite conundrum, Parah Aduma, okay? Now, I just remind you all here that according to the rationalist Jewish philosophers, and we saw several illustrations of them over the past weeks, even Parah Aduma, even the so-called chukim, have rationales, although we may occasionally be unable to appreciate them, which means that Parah Aduma has a rationale, and whatever we perceive to be that rationale would determine from our perspective where, what place it would be assigned amongst the Aseret HaDibrot.
Now, I would put Kashrut in the last one, in the tenth one word.
Good, because
you don't want to eat their food.
Well, I don't know who they are. There's no reason why I can't eat my neighbor's food. If my neighbor invites me over for a meal, there's no reason at all why I shouldn't eat his food. You're on the right track.
If he's not a Jew?
No, that's not. When the Torah says that you shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's donkey or your neighbor's ox, he's not referring to non-Jewish neighbors. It's referring specifically to Jewish neighbors.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No. But I think you had a good idea, because again, what we're looking for now is what does Lo Tachmod represent as a general principle, as a category? And if you think about it as a category that wants us to suppress our desires, to rein in our material desires. So one could look at kashrut. I mean, strictly speaking, what are dietary laws? Dietary laws, strictly speaking, are a way in which to restrain ourselves. So if one would regard the laws of kashrut as intent primarily upon exercising restraint, then they could very well fit under the category of lo tachmod. The point that you were raising might lead us to another conclusion. If we see kashrut primarily as a hedge against assimilation, then you might want to assign kashrut into lo yihyelacha, into the general category of idolatry. Because if indeed it's supposed to prevent assimilation, then of course it would go under the rubric of preventing idolatry. Okay, so now we're going to go through not all, but several of the Aseret HaDibrot sequentially, where I will suggest, based on the Azharot of Saadia, okay, I will suggest what category is represented by that one of the Dibrot, and we'll see which other mitzvot we might come up with on our own to fit into that category. So for example, if I say that Anochi, the first one of the 10 articles, can be defined as a public testimony of faith or a perpetual readiness to acknowledge, as I said, God's unity and God's existence, then which other mitzvot have that as a goal? Now, this is the reason that I had to use this form of the PowerPoint rather than the full screen, because it gives me the opportunity, the option here of covering up some of the answers. Okay. So having given you a moment to think about what other mitzvot have as their objective acknowledging the existence of God or the unity of God or the uniqueness of God, here are some of the mitzvot that Sa'adya Gaon placed in this category, okay, in his liturgical poem in the Azharot. So in the Azharot, among the mitzvot that Sa'adya put into this category, and he actually put, as you see in the center column, a total of 80 mitzvot into this category. It is, in fact, the largest of all of the 10 categories. It contains within it the most mitzvot of any category. And amongst the 80 mitzvot that Sa'adya put under the umbrella of Anochi are tzitzit, tefillin, mezuzah, tefillah, the general obligation of prayer. Okay. Parenthetically, it's actually a machloket of Maimonides and Nachmanides whether prayer is a Torah obligation or a rabbinic obligation. Maimonides regards prayer as a Torah obligation. Nachmanides regards it as a rabbinic obligation. And into the same category, Sa'adya Gaon placed all of the laws of Karbanot. Now we're going to do this not with all of the Ten Commandments, but with several of them. So here we go. If we look at the second commandment, Lo Yiyelecha, not just as an admonition against idolatry, but we look at it from another perspective, as I said, a strenuous reinforcement of the uniqueness and exclusivity of monotheism, then which other mitzvot provide that reinforcement? So here we see that Sa'adya Gaon assigned 60 mitzvot to this category, and among those 60 mitzvot are laws against child sacrifice, laws against practicing magic. He doesn't mean magic like card tricks, right? The prohibition against forms of impurity and intermarriage, right? And as I mentioned previously, this is just the examples that Sa'adya Gaon gave. We could even place, as I said, kashrut amongst them. Let's move on to the third of the Dibrot. Lo tisa, should say sacrilege, I'm sorry for the poor typing, which is literally strictly a prohibition against taking God's name in vain. Swearing, taking an oath in God's name in vain. So here are some of the other, whoops, where did that go? Pardon me, I don't know how I did that. Okay, here we go. Some of the other, again, you see Sa'adya assigned 48 mitzvot to this category. Amongst them are dinim, that it would be, civil law, monetary law, civil law in general. Hakhel, the requirement for the king to gather the people together once every 7 years. Bal Tosif, not seeking to add to the mitzvot of the Torah nor to detract from them. Sinat Chinam, baseless hatred. Tochecha, rebuking one's fellow, all of which, as you see, have as the common denominator among them would be making sure that you keep your word. The fourth of the Dibrot, to Zachor, to remember the Shabbat day, Lekadisho, and to sanctify it. So here we get the answer to one of our previous questions. So, of course, what is more comparable to Shabbat than the principal festivals, the Shalosh Regalim? Okay. But it extends beyond that. It extends to Shemitah, the observance of the sabbatical year, Yovel, the Jubilee year, and interestingly, the Torah requirement to set aside Arei Leviim, cities that would be populated by the Leviim who were not given any territory of their own. Okay, why this would be under the category of Zachor, anyone have a thought about it?
I do.
Please.
The Leviim, because there was, they were landless. They were the ones who basically invented commerce. And because this, you are supposed to avoid dealing with commerce on the Shabbat.
Interesting. That's entirely possible. It might also be, as mentioned, the reason that the Leviim were not landed gentry was because they had to serve a particular function in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, what might associate the Leviim with Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho is the notion of the fact that they've performed sacred tasks in the Mishkan and later in the Beit HaMikdash, and that perhaps would be the connecting element between them. Okay. Let's move now to the fifth of the Dibrot, Kabed et Avicha ve'et Imecha, which again, strictly speaking, obligates one to honor one's father and mother. Okay, but by extension, again, this is again my supposition, right? It affirms the need to maintain what I call useful hierarchical social structures. In other words, a respect for authority. So I ask you, which other mitzvot address the just regulation of Jewish society?
Zakein Mamre.
Okay, it would be anything that would challenge authority. Okay, Zakein Mamre is a law that deals specifically with an elder, not just in the sense of somebody who's collecting Social Security, but an elder in the sense of somebody who is a leader in society, who rebels against the authorities, whether the authority is the king, whether the authority is the Sanhedrin. So, of course, yes, that would be a good example of something that addresses the regulation of an ordered society. Anyone else?
How about the absolute authority of the king?
Good. The institution of monarchy.
Mm-hmm. Good. Zar lo yikrav.
That would be not so much authority as it would be sanctity or impurity, I think. Let's take a look. See what Sa'adya did. This, by the way, is the second largest category of mitzvot amongst the Aseret HaDibrot. Remember that the first one, Anochi, incorporated 80 mitzvot. This one incorporates 77, and here are some of them. Okay. Now, Brit Milah is not so much on the sense of order, society, or authority as much as it's a link to your parents. Okay? As it would be Pidyon HaBein. But Shiluach HaKein, the law that obligates you to dismiss the mother bird before taking the chicks, again, goes to the relationship between generations. And as somebody actually said, the other example that I bring here is, in fact, Melucha, the institution of the monarchy. Okay. Now we move to the second column of the Aseret HaDibrot, Lo Tirtzach. Okay, it can be extended from a prohibition against murder to all regulations with the goal of eliminating bloodshed or with the goal of preventing unnecessary or unwarranted loss of life? And again, here's the question. Can you think of other mitzvot whose objective is to avert unnecessary or unwarranted loss of life?
Build a parapet.
Good. Ma'akeh. That when you build a house, you should place a parapet upon the roof so that people won't inadvertently fall off it.
Someone who strikes a pregnant woman?
Okay, it wouldn't just be a pregnant woman. It could be any laws of torts, anything that had to do with inflicting bodily harm on somebody else.
Egla Arufa.
Okay, the law of the Egla Arufa, the heifer whose neck was broken as a kind of expiation for the guilt that has to be assumed by a community when somebody is randomly murdered in their territory. Good.
What about the fact that you can violate the Shabbat to save a life?
Ah, okay. Hatzalat nefashot, or what the Talmud calls pikuach nefesh. Good. That would be the obverse side of the coin, right?
Right. So along the same lines, giving charity.
Yes, one could extend charity. One could incorporate charity into the regulation of a society. One could incorporate charity into preventing unwarranted or unnecessary loss of life if indeed somebody could become so poor that they couldn't even afford to feed themselves. Good.
Ir miklat,
providing refuge for somebody who committed an act of murder inadvertently, and in order to spare them from the vengeance of what's called the Goel Hadam, of the Avenger. Good.
Batei din.
Pardon?
Batei din, to create it.
Yes, to have a judicial system that would adjudicate questions and determine the extent of people's guilt or innocence. Yeah, I think we came up with more than I actually selected here. Nizikin, as I said, laws of torts. Okay. Now here's a curious one. Okay, because there are forms of spiritual death, right? That might be considered to be the equivalent of physical death. Therefore, he includes in it Ketoret Zara, that is offering incense to an idol, or Navi Sheker, right, claiming to be a prophet under false pretenses. These will not necessarily lead to physical harm, but they could, in fact, if they mislead people and they take them off the straight path and they lead them into idolatry, then in essence, they're leading them into a form of spiritual death. Ma'akeh, again, that's the parapet that somebody mentioned.
What about rape?
Pardon me?
What about rape?
I'm not hearing it clearly.
Rape. When a man rapes a woman.
Oh, yeah, probably. As I'm saying, you know, as I said, I selected only several. This is in each category.
This creates a spiritual or emotional crime.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yes, okay. Except that I wonder whether or not right after Lo Tirtzach is Lo Tinaf. I would say not that you're suggesting rape is certainly a logical one, but I suspect that people would be more likely to consign it to the following one, which is Lo Tinaf. Okay,
Rape is not arguably
all forms of public or even private lewdness.
I think the Torah refers to a rape as much more serious than a regular neifah.
I don't know whether it would be more serious than adultery.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting that Sadia puts gonev nefesh in the previous category of lo tirtzach, because those who feel that that the Ten Commandments, so to speak, refer to the non-observance or the would lead to what do you call it, capital punishment. So they say that lo tigdav actually means gonev nefesh.
That's said, you have to accept that premise. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here are the examples, again, some of the examples of mitzvot that Sa'adya Gaon put into the category of lo tinaf. And as you can see, pretty much they all have something to do with relationships between the sexes. So whether it's the law of sota, a woman who's suspected of infidelity, whether it's yibum and chalitza, the laws of levirate marriage, gerushin, divorce, kli geber, cross-dressing, or for that matter, the positive side of it, the laws that obligate us to establish marriages on the basis of chupa v'kiddushin.
The word adultery there has nothing to do with an adult. It's a form of, it means idolatry.
Sorry?
The word in brackets, a translation, adultery.
Yeah.
It comes from the root of idolatry, not from the root of being an adult.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
What would you do with the mitzvah of learning Torah? I mean, you could argue that bullet falls everywhere.
Well, yes. Or I suppose it, to my mind, it would fit most suitably under Zachor. Again, things that we do, that we actively do in order to affirm an abstract principle. Okay. The next mitzvah, lo tignov, right, encompasses all the safeguards of private property. Perhaps. Along with the social and ritual obligations that the acquisition of private property imposes. Okay, so here, oops, lost the cursor. Schar sachir, right? The obligation to pay a day worker on a daily basis. Shmita ksafim, the annulment of loans in the Shemitah year. Mosnei tzedek, maintaining fair weights and balances. Trumot u'ma'asrot, sharing. Okay. Hasagat vul, establishing boundary lines and prohibiting trespass. And interestingly, hashavat aveda. Not only is there a prohibition against taking something that's not yours, but there's a positive side to it, which is the obligation to return property to its proper owner if you find it.
What about not taking interest on a loan?
Pardon?
Interest on a loan, not taking interest.
Oh, the prohibition against rebit?
Yeah,
oh, surely that would fit in here too.
Gnevat da'at.
Pardon?
Gnevat da'at.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, okay. Gnevat da'at is not per se one of the 613 mitzvot. What there is a lo ta'asev ona'ah. Fraud. And there are two forms that ona'ah takes. Ona'ah can be either ona'at mamon, that's fraudulent business dealings, but there is an alternative form of ona'ah, which is ona'at divarim, and that is fraudulent speech. Indeed, I'm not sure that certainly fraudulent business dealings would fall under lo tignov, because it is effectively a form of robbery. But whether ona'at dvarim would fall in here or whether ona'at dvarim might fall into a different category, that's something we could speculate on. Okay, lo taneh b're'acha ed shaker, the prohibition against bearing false witness. Okay.
What about gzela? What about gzela? Does gzela fall in the category of tignof?
I'm sorry, gzela is not a category. It's a subcategory of geneva. The question, the difference between geneva and gzela is a legal one, but it's not a philosophical one. Doesn't okay. matter if you take something that's not yours, the difference, it's like in law, right? In civil law, okay? There's larceny and there's grand larceny. Both are forms of theft. The difference is only in terms of the extent of the infraction and therefore what the punishment is. So Gneva and Gizela are essentially just different forms of theft. Both of them simply mean to acquire, to take possession of something that's not rightfully yours.
If it was an obligation of someone who owns property, then mezuzah would fit in there.
I'm sorry, mezuzah is not a function of owning property. Renters have to put up mezuzah too.
Oh, you're right. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Please, first of all, don't be sorry. The most interesting thing about this exercise, I've done it on several occasions on the night of Shavuot. Between you and me, I don't really stay up Shavuot night. The staying up Shavuot night was a result of two things that coincided in the city of Tzfat in northern Israel in the 16th century. One of those two things was the Kabbalists, the Mekubalim, and the other was coffee. Okay. Without coffee, even the Mekubalim would probably not have attempted to stay up all night, right? And coffee without the Mekubalim might have kept people up all night, but with nothing to do. It's the fortuitous concatenation, the fortuitous coming together of the Mekubalim and coffee that started the practice of staying up all night of Shavuot. And I never drink coffee, and I'm not a Mekubal. So I don't stay up on Shavuot night unless somebody is willing to pay me to do it. So on several occasions, I was paid to stay up Shavuot night, and I found that this was a wonderful thing to do at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning generally is the time where all people are doing is looking at their watch and counting down to when we're going to start Shacharis. By 4 o'clock in the morning, most of the cheesecake is gone. Sometimes by 4 o'clock in the morning, most of the coffee is gone. So I found that this is actually a wonderful thing to do at 4 o'clock in the morning because everybody has an opinion on it. And come back to what I just started with. Nobody is wrong. There are no wrong answers in this exercise. Because as I said, the question of into which of these categories you would assign this or another mitzvah depends entirely and exclusively upon your understanding of the function that mitzvah serves. And therefore, as I said, there are no wrong answers. I should also, by the way, as long as we're mentioning it, as I see that we're drawing near to the end, if you might actually find this if you go online to Torah in Motion and you look for the sources as you generally do every week, you will find, of course, this this PowerPoint presentation. But I don't think you will have the ability, as I had here, to actually uncover the different answers. So if you want a text of this so that you can to see it in greater detail, I'm just going to put in a plug for myself. If you can see the screen, this is the website of kodeshpress.com. And actually, right here, okay, you can see the one that I'm blinking on and off. Is a book. It's entitled Davar Be'ito, Timely Words. right? It's subtitled Holiday Insights Throughout the Year. If it's out in book form, then it's only a day old. But in it is a chapter that's called the Azharot of Saadia Gaon, an exercise in Tamei HaMitzvot, and you might simply find it a little easier to navigate than the PowerPoint presentation. And if you go to the publisher's website, there's even a discount. But coming back now to conclude, okay, here we get to the last mitzvah, Lo Tachmod, and we already saw, somebody already suggested incorporating kashrut into Lo Tachmod. So indeed, if we see Lo Tachmod as something that can be extended to all mitzvot that attempt to impose a discipline upon the senses, right, then here we have some of the mitzvot that Sa'adya put into it. And we see Sa'adya Gaon indeed placed the mitzvot of kashrut under the rubric of Lo Tachmod, along with Nevelot u'Treifot, that is prohibited foods, Otoved Beno, the prohibition against slaughtering a cow and a calf, the mother and the calf, on the same day, Gid HaNasheh, other things, the prohibition against eating from the sciatic nerve, Kilayim, the prohibition against either sowing two different species, sowing as in planting two different species, or weaving together different species, right? And finally, Nazir, right? What better example is there of someone who imposes strict discipline on his senses than somebody who voluntarily accepts the prohibition, the dietary restrictions of a Nazir? No drinking wine, not even eating grapes, not for that matter, even eating raisins. So these indeed are some of the things that we've seen.
Did he not include incest? Incest and the other sexual averot?
Well, as I said, if there weren't a category of lo tin'af, right, that, as I said, I think it is probably just a more obvious category for sexual misconduct, then, of course, looking at it from that perspective, from the perspective, again, as I said, of placing, of disciplining, the senses, yes, then it could certainly fit there as well.
How Otov et Beno fits in this category? I don't see it.
It can, because if you remember, we actually looked at Otov et Beno as a difference between Maimonides and Nachmanides. The question was whether the reason behind the prohibition is cruelty to animals.
Okay,
allow me to finish. Sorry. Whether the reason for the prohibition is to avoid cruelty to animals, that's what Maimonides seems to say. Nachmanides disagrees with him, and he says, yes, it's to avoid cruelty, but we're not concerned about cruelty to animals. In fact, Nachmanides makes a very good point logically. He said, if God wanted to spare animals cruelty, he would have prohibited us from eating meat. Therefore, he says that the reason for the prohibition against Otov et Beno is not to avoid cruelty to animals. It's to avoid cruelty to ourselves. Because if we take the lives of animals, cheaply, right, then it could even get to the point where we will take human life. We would cheapen the value of human life. So to the extent, what it is imposing some sort of restriction and some sort of discipline. So I imagine that would be the connection.
Where would you put Lo Tikach Emal Banim?
That's the same thing as Otov et Beno. That would be the same thing.
Oh, that's the same category.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And just at the end, just out of curiosity, I just wanted to share this with you. Okay. The Luchot that I showed in one of the opening slides, okay, are the standard Luchot, right? The ones that have five on one side and five on the other side. That's lovely. That's balanced. It's balanced only if you take the number 10 and split it in half. Then you have five and five. But when you stop to look at it, it kind of doesn't make sense. I'll go back to it for a moment, because if you split it five and five, take a look. The left-hand side is pretty much what you see is all there is, meaning the sixth one of the Dibrot is lo tirtzach, period, right? The seventh is lo tinaf, period. Lo tignov, period, okay? Lo taneh, bit longer, lo taneh b'recha ed shakeh, four words, okay? Lo tachmod is maybe a dozen words. Whereas each one of the first five of the Dibrot is extensive, right? Anochi Hashem lo kech asher tzitikha mi'eretz Yisrael beit avadim. Okay? Lo yelacha lo imachirin apana lo taselacha pesel kol tmuna asher v'shamayim imam asher v'ash mitachat. Right? They're extensive. So it's kind of, as I said, this looks balanced only when you're trying to balance the numbers. It's not balanced at all if you're trying to balance the text. And therefore, I thought, I came across this when I was just looking on Google for images of the Ten Commandments. And I thought it was a rather interesting attempt, because what you have here is a balance. And it's not a balance of five and five. It's actually a balance of words. Somebody split the full text of the Aseret HaDibrot in half and placed the first half of it on one tablet and the second half of it on another tablet. Now, of course, it loses something aesthetically. When you look at these, you really can't tell that there are 10 commandments, right? Maybe if he had the idea of either underlining or highlighting the first word in each of the 10 commandments, then that might have accomplished that purpose too. But I just simply thought, as a novel idea, as a way of suggesting that we don't know what the original Luchot looked like. We don't know. For example, here, there are actually two completely separate tablets. Whereas in the previous one, they're not two separate tablets, right? As much as they give the appearance of two tablets, but they're really joined in the center. We really don't know whether the original Ten Commandments were inscribed on two separate tablets that were apart, and that Moshe, so to speak, might have carried one in one hand and one in the other hand, or whether in fact they were two tablets that were somehow miraculously joined together and he carried them as one. But the idea that if in fact we had to split the Ten Commandments amongst two tablets, this idea here of splitting it equally according to the number of words in each of the commandments is, I think, a rather novel idea.
May I ask you something that's not nearly as important as what we've been discussing? Just a grammatical question. The Torah always refers to the Aseret HaDivrot as HaDivarim.
Well, as I said, the singular is actually diber, a chirik under the dalet and a segol under the bet.
Yeah.
It makes an appearance once, I think, in somewhere in the Nevi'im Achronim. I don't remember offhand. But that's what the singular form is. And therefore, the plural really is devarim.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The Aseret HaDibrot is really rabbinic, is Mishnaic Hebrew, not biblical Hebrew.
All right.
Yeah. My personal preference is to call them the 10 articles, as an article, like in Articles of Confederation, because that gives you the idea that these are not 10 narrow specific do's or don'ts, but rather that these are somewhat more broad categories, which, as I said, is what Saadia Gaon's purpose was in his Azharot, in his liturgical poem.
My grandmother emigrated to the Lower East Side. I believe it was fairly early, and she always told this story to me, that when the Moses smashed the commandments, people ran to pick up the pieces. And for the second half, the poor got all the law, and the rich got all the rest. Other word.
Nice. Nice. Thank you.
But that's what I was brought up on. I thought I'd share because, you know, what happened to your grandparents doesn't get shared. It doesn't go on unless you teach it to your kids and mention it to people.
By the way, there happens to be a midrash that in answer to a rhetorical question, namely, Moses spent all of his time teaching Torah to the Jewish people. According to the strict interpretation of rabbinic law, based on Mosaic law, it's forbidden to accept payment for teaching Torah. So if Moses spent all of his time teaching Torah and could not be paid for it, then how did Moses sustain himself and his family? And there is a midrash that actually says that Moses and his family, what kept them going was basically that they had the fragments of the broken luchot. And maybe doesn't say what they did with them, but I suppose that the intimation is that that they sold them to collectors. Oh. In any event, thank you also very much for your company and for your participation. And I wish each and every one of you not just a forthcoming Shabbat Shalom, but also Moadim L'Simcha for Zman Matan Torateinu. I haven't spoken to Rabbi Kelman yet about continuing. But there surely will be something forthcoming, if not over the summer, then certainly right after the summer. So if we will be reunited again on Zoom, I look forward to it.
Thank you very much. Chag Sameach.
All the best.
Can I just say something? Rashi says that Moshe got rich because when he carved the luchos, he was allowed to keep the extra pieces, and it was under his tent.
I thought the term was shivrei luchot.
The shivrei luchot,
I thought it's when he carved the new ones.
Ah, okay. I thought shivrei luchot were the fragments of the first luchot that he broke.
No, the first luchot were kept in the Aron.
I think he's not referring to Moshe Rabbeinu. It's referring to Moshe Dayan, who used to collect
articles. You mean steel.
Yeah, I'm being slight.
Slightly.
Marty, that's very funny.
Who that?
All right. I don't see Maxine, but I'm sure that she would want me to remind everybody that the usual list of classes by Rabbi Kelman and by others will of course meet at their accustomed times in their accustomed places.
Indeed, thank you. And we're going to be starting a few more series after Shavuot. So keep an eye out for those. There's going to be Dr. Daniel Lasker teaching about Karaite Judaism. Lori Novick is going to be looking at Levina's writing on the Talmud. So some interesting things are coming up. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Very good.
Bye-bye. All the best. All the best. Shalom.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Shabbat shalom.
Bye-bye.
Bye.